Hello, everybody. Welcome to yet another episode of Lost in IKEA, my podcast. My name is Alex. And today I have a guest by the name of Stefano Mancini. Please introduce yourself, Stefano.
My name is Stefano, and through good fortune and destiny, I was fated to be on this podcast after meeting Alex Kasparian. And it is a real privilege and honor to be here and to be talking to you, dear listener, as well.
Amazing. That was the most well-stated first thing I think one of my guests have had.
So thank you. I mean, there's so much I could introduce. I'd like to think of myself as a man of talent, a man of mystery, but perhaps that will be revealed throughout today.
Okay, yeah. We'll really just kind of go through wherever this conversation takes us. The only thing that you must discuss is how you know who I am, how we've become the friends I would like to say that we are.
I'll have to think on that one.
Okay, okay. But how do we know each other, Stefano?
Well, I don't think you're going to like...
Sorry. I'm really sorry to interrupt you. Okay, this is staying on my pants. It's fine. Go ahead.
White pants and the grats was a risk, although... I do have some lighter pants,
this
too.
This is not even a grass stain. I have no idea what this is. Mm. This is not dirt. It's, like, black. Okay, sorry. Continue. Go ahead.
Well, to be truthful, Alex, the first time I was aware of your existence was when I saw you on Tinder and gave you a super like. I don't know if you received that.
I think I did.
That was sophomore year.
That's so funny. I think I did receive that. I was active, quite active, on the Tinder Lafayette. I loved it, actually. I thought it was so funny. Okay,
It was hilarious.
I'm glad you super liked me, because some people, when they see other people, they will get really shy, and I thought it was so funny to see people at Lafayette. I'd be like, funny seeing you here. I guess I didn't reply to you.
Yeah, we can discuss what happened another time, but no hard feelings.
Okay. All right, so is that all you have to say?
Then, by another miracle of the internet, I was paired with Alex in the WJRH playlist trade, and it turned out that Alex and I had very similar music tastes. Quite honestly, making a playlist for her was just kind of telling her music she already liked.
This is true.
But it was still a privilege to be able to bond over music, and destiny faded again, and we've become friends senior year, and I couldn't be more glad. We make prints together, we hang out together, we sing together in a non-class way, just we sing
together.
Didn't we do karaoke together once?
No.
You've never been to karaoke?
I have been to karaoke, but I've never...
Not with me?
Explicitly sang with you. I think we might have been in the same room together at karaoke, but I wouldn't consider that singing together.
I'd sing along while you're up there.
I have sang at karaoke. I sang most recently, like several months ago, Gimme, 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 I believe, for Mama Mia.
I feel like I was there one night when you did that.
Well, that day I had COVID, so I probably had, well, that's part of the gray area of me having COVID, was that day.
Let's hope I wasn't there.
Did you get COVID in February when we had COVID?
I did not, because I had some gorgeous antibodies from December.
Oh, yeah. No, I remember somebody that night, I won't say their name, somebody that night had COVID, and I found out that they did, and I was like, whatever. And then I kept going about my life, went to several social events, and whoop-de-frickin-do, Monday morning, I test positive for COVID.
Yeah, the beginning of the semester was interesting. I'm thinking about the historians and maybe even budding historians in classes. Who want to know about the pandemic, you know, 100 years from now, centuries from now. And going to college in a pandemic, it's interesting. There's a lot of, like, just confusion going around, a lot of rumor, a lot of uncertainty about whether you're cleared to go to an event or not.
Right. I do wonder what insights we'll be able to provide people in the future. Because I feel like college is a very social living environment that, like, most people don't have. So we're really in the epicenter of the pandemic in some ways.
We are.
College kids don't get a good rap for following the rules. So.
No, and that's a good thing, although not so much during a pandemic.
Correct. College rule breaking usually is, I don't know, well received.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, think about underage drinking for one.
I'm not going to condone that on public radio.
I'm not personally condoning it. I'm saying that as a public opinion, you know. Mm. The fact that we talk about underage drinking shows how not stigmatized it is.
True.
So, I guess in a way it's implicitly accepted. Whether or not by the institution, I cannot say.
That's a head RA.
Just a regular RA.
You're just a regular?
Yes.
Why did I think you were a head one?
I don't know.
Well, you're quite a good one from what I know.
Oh, thank you. I used to be better in the past. Now my senioritis is in full effect.
That's the other pandemic.
I don't even know if I would call senioritis a pandemic because it's never ending. It's
endemic.
It's just an effect. It's just something that happens. A phenomenon.
Mm. Is it socially constructed or deep-seated inside us? I don't think we'll ever know.
I think it's deep-seated inside us. Because if it were socially constructed, then there would be some backlash.
Mm.
But the notion of backlash contradicts senioritis, because senioritis is like, don't, like, put any effort into anything. So to participate in backlash would be counterintuitive to senioritis. Therefore, it's not a social construction.
I think to some extent it's constructed.
Okay.
I think it's a cultural phenomenon of the idea of youth as something liberating and freeing, right? In a time of carefreeness.
Yeah. Perhaps we buy into it also. Like, we just, like, placebo ourselves into being like, oh, I have senioritis. Or maybe, you know, you don't, but you think you do because of the social construct.
You know, I could maybe be doing an essay right now. I could be doing an essay right now. And Alex is like, come on my podcast. And, you know, I guess this is my senioritis, being on a podcast instead of working on an essay.
Do you feel like you're missing out on an academic opportunity by being here?
I think this is an academic opportunity in many ways. I don't know if the administrators in Merkel will see it that way. But I believe there's learning and growth, some skills being bolstered, some connections being formed that can never happen in the classroom. Right here, overlooking the city of Easton, in front of the Civil War statue, I guess behind the Civil War statue.
Right.
McDonald's in full view, Sunwood Square in full view, Sunwood Square construction in full view.
Yeah, this would be a great opportunity to acknowledge the fact that we are outside. This podcast is being recorded in the great outdoors at the, it's not the apex. I want to say the apex of the hill, but it's not, because it still goes up more.
Oh, it goes up much more. But I found out yesterday on a long walk.
Where'd you go?
I went to the Chateau.
What is that?
You've never heard of the Chateau.
Is that higher elevation than Gallup Park?
It's about the elevation of Gallup Park.
Okay. I went to Gallup Park 2 days ago.
Yeah.
Walked there.
What did you do at Gallup Park?
I went to St. Anthony's Nose, which is a local viewpoint.
I didn't know about that.
I learned about it last year. I learned about it in my art and the environment course.
Ooh.
Here at Lafayette. Our professor, Nestor Heal, instructed us to go as an assignment and take a picture of our view there. Do you know this story?
I've heard lots of stories about Nestor Heal from you and others,
but... No, the story about my trip to St. Anthony's Nose.
I don't think so. I don't think I've heard this. It's only 2 days old. It's not in the gossip yet, you know?
No. This was from last year.
Oh, you've gone twice.
I've been more than twice now.
Oh, wow.
But anyways, I'll tell you the story from 2 years ago when I was first introduced to the site. This is an excellent story, so lucky you viewers get, or listeners, get to hear it. So, I'm going to be quiet, just paying attention to the sound. So, basically, he assigned us to go to St. Anthony's Nose, and I put it on my map. I typed in St. Anthony's Nose on Google Maps, and had some trouble. Like, it didn't pop up as, like, a location here, the directions to there. So I just kind of saw that it would be in Gala Park at the edge of it. And I plopped a pin. I made my own pin point on Google Maps. And I looked it up. And he said it was going to be a hike. He said it was going to be far. It would take some time. So it took. It said it was going to take me, like, an hour, hour and something to get there. So I begin my walk to the point that I had. And I had no idea where I was going. I had never been there before. I took it as an opportunity to go on a nice, like, scenic walk on my own, which I normally like doing.
Excellent.
So I didn't ask anybody for to join me. And I'm walking, I'm walking, I'm walking, like, far out of, like, my radius that I've ever been. And I find myself walking, like, along the side of a highway or a main road. And I'm like, oh, this is interesting. Like,
yeah.
This is kind of a dangerous walk that Nestor's put me on. And I'm walking, I'm walking, I'm walking, and I'm not increasing my elevation. I don't understand what my, like, scenic viewpoint is.
Mm-hmm.
I see signs, like, on the road that say, like, not scenic overlook, but, like, photo spot or whatever.
Yeah.
But it is not at those points where my map tells me I'm there. It is at a random point that my map is, like, you're at St. Anthony's Note, or you're at the coordinates that you put.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing special about this scene. It's just a spot along the road. And I look up, and to my side that I've been walking is this large cliff. And it's apparent to me that I walked along the length of the bottom of the cliff and the park and was not where I was supposed to be. So I walked to the bottom of St. Anthony's Nose and did not get the same view as my classmates.
Ah, and you didn't make it up there.
No. It was also during this time where we had our stick project. Remember, we'd carry sticks around for the whole semester? So I had to bring my stick to this point and take a picture. I took a sad selfie with my sticks at the bottom of the cliff. And that was that. But then I went back a couple days ago. I've been back many times. It's a beautiful view. I highly recommend.
What do you get to see?
I'll show you. It's a view of the river and the, like, natural mountain slash hills.
The Poconos. Blue Mountain.
I don't even know if I would say it's that much. It's really just this.
Ah, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Can you see, like, the city of Easton at all?
No.
Oh, that's a shame. That would make food creepy.
I don't really have great geographic understanding, but I don't think you can see the city of Easton because it's just, like, one view. You can't do a 360. So this is all you get, is this view.
And that's not the bottom of the cliff.
No, this is the top of the cliff. This is the
very
view
important
that we were supposed to have that I missed, that I've since gotten many times later.
It's quite nice, though.
It is. I very much enjoyed that. But you went to the apex of somewhere else.
Yes, I went to the Chateau Chavagnac.
Okay.
Now, if you Google Chateau Chavagnac, you will find that that was the Marquis de Lafayette's mansion in France. However,
you walked to France.
I walked to France. Well, the Kirbys decided to buy I think winter or fall retreat for football season in Easton on Paxinosa Road at the top of College Hill, kind of close to Giant.
Okay.
And they named it the Chateau de Chavagnac. They might have built it themselves.
Does it all come back to the Kirbys, Stefano?
I think it all might come back to the Kirbys. I mean, we're grateful for their donations, to be certain.
Yeah. How long have they been involved in this institution?
Well, I think it might be Fred Morgan Kirby, who the Kirby Hall of Civil Rights is named after. I think he found an interest in Lafayette, but I don't think he was an alum. But many of his family have been alums. I am not the expert here, so I really hope I'm saying truths here.
It's okay if you're not. I condone you.
Thank you.
And now we bring in our guest, the Sam Kirby. I'm kidding. He is not here. I've never spoken to him. If he was standing in front of me, I would not know what he looks like. I have very poor recognition of many people in our year. People have told me this. They're like, how do you not know XYZ person? And I'm like, I don't know. I just know who I know, and I'm content with that, I think.
That's valid. I mean, there's not much more time for friendship these days anyway.
This is true. This is very true.
Thank you.
witnessing a disaster here. It looks like everyone's okay, but I... Do you see that dust? I think that's dust from that car.
No.
Maybe I'm seeing things.
I don't see any dust. But I believe that was just a car, you know, someone who likes to really flex their muscles doing that.
I've never driven down that part of Easton. 4 years and I haven't.
Which way?
Down in Sunnyside Square downtown.
Do you drive?
Not here.
Okay.
I don't have my car here. Because I didn't think I'd need it.
I thought that I would enjoy it, but it was simply not in the cards for me because my car... I drive a 2003 Toyota Avalon.
Oh, yes.
And it is not in the best shape. It has been in pretty poor shape since I stopped driving it regularly in high school.
Ah.
And... Yeah. So I didn't think it would make it here. My parents really didn't think it would make it here. So it's just been falling apart in my driveway for the past, like, 4 years. But people occasionally lend me their cars. I used to drive the EMS. We used to have a Ford SUV that I would drive to the ambulance bay in Easton, so.
To Med Bay. Sounds sus.
Not Med Bay.
Among Us jokes, for the record,
I see.
Viewer, it's about a year, if not 2 years, out of date, but I'd still find a little enjoyment in them.
I have never played that game.
Really?
Yeah.
What did you do during quarantine?
I watched all 5 seasons of Breaking Bad. I got into Criminal Minds. I began knitting.
Knitting. I always wanted to try.
It was a great pastime. I really enjoyed knitting. I thought about doing it for, like, many weeks, and one day I decided, okay, I'm going to start this, so I went to Michael's. This is not a paid promotion. I went to my local Michael's, and I bought some knitting needles, some yarn, and I sat at my kitchen table and cried for 3 hours because I couldn't do it. And then my mom asked me, Alex, why did you think that you'd become an immediate expert in this craft that you've never, ever, ever done? And why did you think that you'd be able to make an entire project in one day when you've never done this before? To which I did not reply, however, kept pursuing. And I eventually figured it out and I made something.
So wise of you, Mom. I think that's very true advice.
Yeah, I'm quite stubborn and I have very high expectations of myself. This is pre-senioritis. It was fair. It was a fair... I needed to hear that. I needed her to say to me, you know, it's okay that you couldn't do this immediately. It took practice. It took time. Now, I can do some basic level knitting. I have not really improved since, like, what I learned in my first week of knitting, and that's fine.
What kinds of things do you make?
I have only completed one project. I did it, like, that summer. It was a laptop case. I don't have it on me now. It was basically just, like, a long rectangle that I folded over and then folded over again to make, like, a lip. I attached 2 buttons to it. And I've been working on a blanket for the better half of ever since I started my knitting, like, 2 years ago, and it's probably never going to get done. I know. So, yeah. Would you consider yourself crafty?
Not really, and I'd really like to get crafty. Taking a printmaking class has really awakened me to the power of arts and crafts.
Would you say that printmaking is an exercise in arts and crafts?
I think that we would want to deem it a little more in the high art, haute couture world than that.
Mm-hmm.
But at its core, I think everything is arts and crafts, isn't it?
I guess. I associate arts and crafts with being juvenile.
Mm.
Although, at some point, kids do become experts of arts and crafts. In the same way that the famous artists of the world are experts at their craft.
Mm.
So, I would say I'm an expert in making block letters, for example.
Really?
I've been doing it for, I don't know,
wow.
15 years, I guess. Some people are very bad at it, and I'm very good at it.
I've been making stick figures for 15 years, so I think I'd say I'm an expert in that as well.
Do you feel like you're an expert in that, or do you just say that because you've been practicing for so long?
Well, I think I'd need to enter a competition to see how it all stacks up.
I see. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've never been in a competition for my art. Mm. Actually, no, in 7th grade I did win some art award. Many, many years ago. But my art teacher really did the large labor of the work for me. She was like, you should touch it up like this. And I was like, oh my god, that's really great. Can you do more? And then I ended up winning like an award.
Ah.
And I really do credit her for the major art successes that this, it was a painting of a flower. Yeah.
I mean, you've had so many art successes since then.
This is true. None recognized by any art critique board or whatever, or by the school for that matter.
Ooh.
But not that I am just saying I've never won an award for my art. But I would say that I've had personal successes with art. Yeah.
You've won my prize for being one of my favorite printmakers, so
thank you.
I think that should speak volumes.
Oh, thank you very much. What is the... Is there any tangible compensation related to that award or no?
Well, my love and affection is priceless.
I see. Intangible, however.
Don't you feel the love right now? Doesn't it feel so tangible, Alex?
If I close my eyes, I suppose I do feel the coldness of your hands. I feel like you'd have cold hands. Oh, wow!
Warm-blooded.
Stefano's hands are surprisingly warm. You give off... Some people have poor circulation, and some people have warm hands. I have warm hands, if you couldn't tell there.
Yeah.
Some people... I'll say her name. Danielle Mullen. Horrible circulation, if you ever feel her hands. Her hands are always cold and clammy.
You know something about biology.
Tell me.
Well, I want you to tell me.
Oh, yes, I do know something about biology.
Why does that happen?
Why do some people have worse circulation than others? I don't know.
How do I make sure I never have cold and clammy hands? No offense, Danielle.
I don't know. I don't know what makes one person have less cold and clammy hands, to be honest with you. I could do some research on it right now, if you want.
Well, it's your show. I don't know if this is a research show.
It could. No, I'm open to fostering some academic contemplations. Why do some people, I'm using Google, why do some people have cold hands? Yeah, no shit. Okay, so this says that cold hands may be caused by simply being in a cold room. Hmm. Although that is not the
answer. I wouldn't have thought that.
I mean, when my hands are naturally warm, and so when I am really cold and my hands get cold, that's when I know. Do your hands get cold sometimes?
Every so often, but I'd like to think that I keep them at a pretty stable, warm temperature.
I see. Yeah, only when I'm, like, freezing do my hands get cold.
I always wear some socks, too. I think that helps.
Yes, I do. I did bring socks with me in case my feet got cold.
Boots and socks are really the move tonight, Alex,
they
I think.
Are. I was wearing Crocs all day, but I took them off and I happened to slide these bad boys on before I walked out the door. Cold hands are often a sign that your body is trying to maintain its normal body temperature. I don't think that applies because that would insinuate that everybody who has cold hands chronically is always at the wrong body temperature and their body is trying to maintain it and is not doing a good job. So I don't think that's true. Mm. Number three, this is by the Mayo Clinic. Always having cold hands, however, could mean there's a problem with your blood flow or blood vessels in your hands. Yeah, I said poor circulation. I should write for the Mayo Clinic. Mm. I mean... I don't know, Stefano. This did not help. Let me go to PA school for a little bit and I'll get back to you on that.
I'm so glad you're solving life's greatest mysteries.
Yeah, just for that. I'm really only going so that I can answer people's medical questions. It's not even for my own personal satisfaction.
Wow, so selfless and kind.
Yeah. Sometimes I do think, I'm like, would a doctor be able to answer this question I have? What if there was a doctor who was not there to provide, like, life-saving care, but they were just there to answer, like, stupid medical questions. Or, not stupid, but curious. Curious, but not relevant medical questions.
I thought that's what WebMD is for.
No, WebMD is an actual diagnostic tool.
It's a... Do you like it?
I've never used it as a diagnostic tool, because I know that some people have told me that they'll, like, type their symptoms in, and then it tells them they have something that they might or might not have, but either way, still scares them.
Yeah.
Because it makes them think they have something, which they might, but mm-hmm. I think in order to properly diagnose, you need, like, a conversation rather than, like, a questionnaire, you know? Mm. An example of a silly med question is, so I had lunch today, and a conversation I had over lunch was, what would it be like to have a sixth toe? To which my immediate response was, well, your balance would be really off, because your toes are very important for your balance. But do I know the answer? No.
I feel like a sixth toe would just sit there, you know?
Mm. Perhaps. It depends on what I was saying. My argument was, it depends on where on your foot the toe is.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah.
You've given me a lot to think about.
I always have great things to think about. You let me know, and I'll give you a pointless yet thought-provoking question. Mm.
Does having more hair make you warmer?
I think it's meant to, but we defy the evolutionary benefits of that by moving to cold or warm places and clothing ourselves, that it's no longer relevant, you know? Like, I feel like before industrialization and people, like, really moved, hair was more important. Or I guess really, like, we began clothing ourselves. This might be more, like, historical than you might have thought.
Hmm.
But I think that, yeah, that's my answer.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, stereotyped images of medieval people always include men's luscious locks.
On their head.
On their head.
I see. I don't think I would ever consider, or I have ever heard anybody consider, body hair other than on your head as luscious.
I don't want to know what that would look like.
Right. Unless it's like the length of, like, imagine like having leg hair the length of like head hair. That'd be quite interesting.
I think I need to lie down. That's a lot.
Do you want to move the mic such that we can lie down and do this?
I think I'll be okay.
Okay. For example, I think of a horse, you know, a horse's tail is quite long.
Mm.
That, I would say, is luscious for sure. Luscious locks.
Yes.
Yeah. The more you know.
We should have a viewer call in.
Nobody can call into this. This is not being broadcast anywhere right now.
You should call a friend, Alex.
We didn't get a phone. Are you not content with our conversation right now?
Oh, I'm having an excellent time, such that I want more involvement.
Oh, who do you want to call?
Ghostbusters.
I set myself up for that. Would you like to engage someone, really?
I mean, that's up to you. But I think we can handle it on our own.
I think we could. Unless you want, like, a brief one-minute guest. I don't know. That's up to you, I guess. What would you like to get out of this show? It's really just about... This is really just about, you know, us talking and capturing our time together. It can be spent in whatever way you would like.
Well, I want it to be authentic to how we would spend time together. And, you know, Alex and I have had conversations at Upper that lasted hours.
Uh-huh.
Conversations not at Upper that lasted hours. Days in printmaking where we just looked at each other like, oh my god, what's going on? Mm-hmm. Days in printmaking where we cried. Days in printmaking where
I've never cried in printmaking.
Some of us have.
Not with you, anyways. Mm. I cry alone in printmaking. Yeah. Printmaking is very... It takes the... Not that it takes the fun out of art,
mm-hmm.
but it is so calculated, I think. and very, maybe it's just the class, not like the practice, but the fact that there's like time pressure and like material restrictions.
Yeah. I mean, everything is really expensive, you know. It's a very accessible medium in that you can reproduce anything, like, very easily. But, on the other hand, I mean, it's intensely difficult because you need all of these different chemicals and, like, all of these different... You know, I guess wood blocks, especially if you use, like, linoleum instead of wood, but that might be a little cheaper, but even still.
Yeah, but I don't think anybody at, like, home... I don't think your average plebe would have be like, oh yeah, I have a printmaking studio in my garage.
Yeah.
It's fully functional.
Like, who's gonna buy emulsion?
Right. Which is...
Who's gonna buy ink, even?
Right. And you have to have multiple colors. I mean, I guess you could do intaglio, but... The thing with woodblock and intaglio that I hate is the cleanup.
Yeah, it's the cleanup. It's horrible. And does involve some chemicals you might not have at home either.
Right, you have to have a chemical hood, actually. But screen printing, while you do need emulsion, the cleanup is only requires water. Actually, no, you need that's a lot. You need reclaimer as well. So
sounds like I may never print make again.
Sounds like neither of us will, Stefano.
That's a shame.
Although I'm sure the EPI would welcome us
as resident artists, as real guests who are connoisseurs and legends in the printmaking sphere.
I think we will be well regarded in the history of the EPI, the Experimental Printmaking Institute of Lafayette College. I think they would warm welcome us.
My work was avant-garde.
It was avant-garde.
And your work was deeply meaningful and deeply engaging.
Would you not say that both of those descriptions could apply to both of ours?
I think that's fair. I think we pushed the envelope.
I am receiving a phone call.
Wow, we have a guest calling in. I summoned.
No, I'm not going to take it. I will let them know we cannot do this.
Alex, it's so popular.
What is popularity in college, anyways?
The only person you need to be popular with is yourself.
Wow. That was really wise and philosophical. Do you have anything else that you would like to proclaim?
I prefer strawberry jam to crepe.
Thoughts on jam versus jelly?
I like a little bit of both. I think jam is just a more exciting palate experience. I think jelly is a little basic, but I think there's room for both in my cabinet.
I agree. Jam is strongly preferred for its textural variety. I don't understand the difference between a jam and a... The other day I went to a trolley stop, and I had like a strawberry shortcake, and it had a... Compote. What's the difference between compote and jam?
Isn't compote warm? Was it warm when you ate it? I could be entirely wrong.
I don't know.
You know, I wrote my thesis on labor history with an element of food history. But that doesn't make me an expert on anything. But I think they're very similar. I feel like compote is warm.
Let me look it up.
Warm and maybe a bit thinner. Did you feel it was thin?
Yes, thinner than the jam that I'm envisioning. Oh. Okay, well... The one and only difference that's been provided by foodandwine.com is that compote leaves fruit intact. They're left whole.
Oh.
Whereas in jam, the fruit matter is broken up into a more spreadable form.
There we go.
Jam is also designed to last in the refrigerator. Most compotes have less sugar than a typical jar of jam. But you know what? There are so many other types of spreadable fruit that we're not considering that I'm reading about now. I wouldn't have considered these in my head, but there's jam, jelly, preserve, compote, marmalade, chutney.
Chutney.
Chutney. So, we're just touching on the edge of the spectrum.
There's a pool that we should just dive into. And that pool is made of strawberry compote.
Confit?
Confit. I've had duck confit.
Is it confit just like really, really rich and yet spreadable?
Isn't it? That's what my duck confit was like.
I've never had confit, I don't think, but I think that the only engagement I have had with it, like visually, is garlic.
Mm.
You just like put garlic in put it in a lot of oil and let it sit and absorb. Maybe you cook it. I don't remember, to be honest.
Garlic confit is a thing. I've seen it probably on Bon Appetit.
Like Bon Appetit, the Lafayette College.
No, the YouTube channel / food magazine.
Oh, I've never heard of it.
Oh, wow. It's a really famous one. Claire Saffitz worked there. Saffitz?
I don't know who you're talking about.
Wow. You don't know? You're 21st century food people.
No,
if only you had done your thesis on cookbooks and conduct guides. Guides are important.
It appears that I did not do the proper thesis, which was no thesis at all. I am about as far removed from my degree as I've ever been.
Really? Because you've been taking so much art?
I guess because of the art, but more importantly because I am not taking any biology classes because I finished my requirements for those last semester.
And you needed a break, I imagine.
Yeah, I wasn't going to take more for funsies. Well, given the Lafayette course offerings, none of them were so interesting that they were willing, or that I was willing to take them for funsies.
Were you the one telling me that you wished that Lafayette had more human-centered options rather than plant and animal?
It might have been me, it might not have been me, but that is a statement with which I agree.
Mm.
Lafayette does a lot of focus on animal and plant biology, and not specifically on human biology, even though human biology is the large majority of postgraduate programs that people pursue.
Mm. Why do you think that is?
Why don't they offer it, or why do most people pursue it?
Why don't they offer it?
I've actually had a discussion with the biology department about this. I've expressed my grievances, and I was told that for example, human anatomy is a course that many institutions across the country offer. I asked the school why we don't offer human anatomy, and they said because we would need an MD, a medical doctor, to teach that course. And I said, okay, fair, like, basic argument. But then I asked, well, then why do we have a human physiology course? And they said, well, any physiologist can teach human physiology. It's just an applied version. I was like, then why can't any person who knows anatomy teach human anatomy?
It's strange.
Right?
I'll never understand the inner workings of academe.
It's quite frustrating.
But I hope that you have learned things in your education nonetheless. I hope you have become a better biologist and a better person and someone who is ready to take on PA school with vigor and belief and a good heart.
Yes, thank you. I was joking earlier when I made a comment that I was solely doing the physician assistant program to answer stupid questions and not for my own personal validation. I'm incredibly eager about pursuing this career.
People will ask you things and then you'll feel good about yourself.
No. Because I'll be able to, like, treat people.
Ah.
And, like, provide medical care is, like, the basic thing.
Incredible.
Yes, I'll be able to answer medical questions, but that's not, like, the primary reason. Being a PA is a medical career that is heavily patient-focused. Like, you could be a doctor. I mean, you could be a doctor of medicine and never once talk to a patient. You could just, like, work in a lab all day long.
Huh.
In the same way that I guess you could be a doctor of history and just, I don't know, work in the study of the future. And never.
I don't know about that one.
I didn't have a comparison for you.
Because I think the point of history is they're not supposed to be alive.
I see. So are all historians useless until they're dead? Or did I just
gonna have to think?
You
no, I mean,
if you're
you won't really be known in. I mean, you won't be studied by a historian unless you're dead, really. And I think any good historian needs to be able to tie it back to today. I think any good historian needs to understand how long phenomena show continuity with today, and how things that happen today have roots that are decades and even centuries old, and be able to know not only when things change, but when things stay the same.
Well said.
Because many of the things that stay the same are oppressions.
Interesting.
But, you can't really be studied in history unless you're dead.
Would you say that the nirvana afterlife, like the pinnacle of being a historian, is becoming one with history and joining the collection of history by dying?
We call that historiography.
No, but like a person, like in your personhood, joining history by physically being a part of it.
We study them. We have all kinds of historical schools that are people who were historians.
Right, and are they?
And then their methodologies fell in and out of favor.
Do you think they're glorified for being dead? I don't think you're understanding my question.
I don't think you're understanding mine.
No, I think we're both trying to ask each other things, and we're both trying not to answer them by pushing our own questions.
I mean, I'm excited to enter history one day. I'm happy with my life, and I'm excited to live a long and healthful and fruitful one.
Right, I guess I'm not asking you if you're excited to die, but...
But, truly, I mean, I do hope future historians do look at my life and the things that happen in it and understand the larger phenomena that occurred socially, right?
Do you look forward, or do you plan to pursue a career in women's domesticity?
I'm not certain about that. We are doing soul searching right now, but, you know, I'm really proud of the work I've done here. I mean, I've looked at late medieval women's history. I've looked at my thesis is on early modern women's history and kind of the slow emergence of the domestic, because we need to understand that misogyny has placed women in the domestic for a long time, but binaries of public and private and outward facing and domestic also don't really map on well to medieval and early modern history, because the household is the unit, really, of economic production.
Right.
I've also looked at modern history. I currently have my exhibit in Skillman Library that focuses on 20th century cookbooks and culinary ephemera, and so much of that discusses things like domesticity and this post-Victorian into 20th century, especially 1950s, belief that women will find satisfaction and fulfillment through cooking for others.
I see. Could you define ephemera for the listenership?
Of course, and does the listenership include Alex?
Yes.
Ephemera, so you know the word ephemeral.
It brings about thoughts of like not euphoria, like the opposite of nostalgia, in being like something's ephemeral, it's like eternal, but like also positive.
The definition of ephemera that I use is it's something fleeting. Like, something ephemeral, it's like, maybe our time in college is ephemeral. Maybe this very moment, right, is ephemeral. Mm. At some point, we're going to end the show, and we're going to be all sad.
Mm-hmm.
But it was ephemeral. It was brief and beautiful.
Okay.
And ephemera, in a culinary sense, in a book sense, means something that it's not really meant to last forever. Cookbooks are meant to last a while. They're meant to be put on a shelf. They're meant to be looked at and consulted frequently.
Okay.
Ephemera are not as well produced. They're cheaper to buy.
Is ephemera the plural of ephemerum? Like, is ephemera referring to a plural collective?
You know, I'm going to be honest. I cannot say I know the answer to that. I personally use ephemera as singular and plural.
Okay.
But I think that's a really astute linguistic observation. Your lexicon is quite luscious.
Wow, bringing lusciousness back into the circle.
Of course. So ephemera are things like advertisements. They're like mini cookbooks. They're all these kinds of things that are like semi cookbooks, but really not meant to be kept. Things that you imagine like a magazine in some ways. A magazine isn't quite ephemera, but that's a pretty good contemporary example.
Okay.
Actually, a great example I think would be like, you know, when it's election season and the politicians send you mail.
Yes.
You're not really meant to keep that past the election, but it still has a purpose.
I understand.
Right? And that's what these ephemera are. They have recipes in them. They have product advertisements. They tell you how to use this product, right? But they're really not meant to be, like, on your shelf for the rest of your life.
I like the notion of the ephemera.
Yeah.
I think that much of our consumerism is, when you think of it, compiled of ephemera.
Yeah, no, that's fairly true.
Can you do me a favor and define some other things for me? I'm just looking for a consensus because, okay, in my religion class, I'm currently writing a paper on China in, like, the... I actually don't have a specific time period. It's all of Chinese... I'm basically referring to all of Chinese history before the now... And I guess now is modern, and I'm saying pre-modern.
Yeah.
But then there's also post-modern, which I don't understand if modern is now. What does it mean for something to be pre- and post-modern? And I guess modern in relation to those.
You have asked the central question in historiography.
Oh, really?
Which is, we call this periodization. Mm. How do we define different historical eras? And do they matter? Do historical eras matter? Mm-hmm. It's a really tough one.
I'm looking for a simple answer stuff now.
So antiquity lasts until about 300-ish, until about the fall of the Roman Empire.
Okay.
Now the central question with that is, when did the Roman Empire fall? Which is a really
496.
See, 496 antiquity could end.
Was it 496? Did I get that right?
Maybe. I don't...
396?
I feel like it was in the 300... I don't know. 512? I don't know. In any case,
okay.
Antiquity, it's kind of until the Roman Empire ends, and then starts medieval.
Okay.
Medieval is a lot of history because a lot of things happen because it lasts for, like, 1,000 years.
Okay.
And so there's, like... Early medieval, high medieval, late medieval.
What point do we decide? Why do we decide that medieval's over? What makes a period not medieval?
That's what I'm getting to next. Okay. So, there are many times where the medieval period ends, and it really depends on what geographic area you're looking at.
I see. That makes sense.
In my mind, I personally end the medieval period in 1492, which is when Columbus comes to the Americas and the... Reconquista of Spain happens.
I see.
And so that's a time where early modernity, right, means that modern is starting and it's not quite happening yet. And obviously that's a really fuzzy way to talk about things because these people don't expect to, like, become modern, whatever that means.
Right.
They're just living. In many ways, they're late, late medieval, too.
Right. What, yeah.
Modern.
Or would you ever say, like, post-medieval?
Post-medieval is the name of a medieval studies journal that it's known for their, like, very great theoretical work. And I think their idea is going beyond what we usually think of as medieval, so embracing, like, questions about, like, race and gender, large theoretical questions that for a long time in medieval studies... has been subjugated. So I think the subtitle to post-medieval is like a journal of pre-modern cultural studies or something. I can't remember the exact language. So the early modern period also does not have an easy ending point.
Right.
But, I mean, lots of things happen, right? The Renaissance, which is a bad term because the Renaissance is really a recovery of antiquity, and it's kind of like an advertising term meant to, like, make us like them. Even though, like, right, because the Dark Ages, which is another name for medieval, comes out of ideas of the Renaissance.
Dark Ages is the medieval time.
Yes, but Dark Ages never happened because the Middle Ages are full of learning and life. Right.
When was the Middle Ages?
like 300 or 500.
Well, you said it was antiquity and then medieval.
Yes.
So is...
Medieval, it's essentially the same thing as Middle Ages.
Okay.
Yeah.
And also Dark Ages.
And also Dark Ages, which is not a term I ever use nor recommend using, because again, there's lots of learning going on in Europe at this time. There's a great exchange with the Mediterranean and Muslim worlds of philosophy and medical knowledge.
When was the plague?
The plague, I believe, started in 1348.
Okay.
And the plague was obviously huge. I mean, like, over a third of Europe dies in it.
Correct.
And it's transformative. It starts a period which is thought of often as really good for women's rights and really good for the rights of, like, peasants and laborers.
Interesting.
Because there's a real need for women to go into work in places, like, beyond the home, and a lack of husbands, right, to tell women what to do, and a lack of fathers. Plus, just generally, like, a need for employment positions. So laborers do great. They extract really high wages at the time.
Mm. When was feudalism?
Feudalism, it's a really hard term.
These are just the words that I know in my head that have no... I really did not do well in my history classes because, like, well, it wasn't even called history at the time. It was called social science.
Yeah.
And I just, like, I would study a little bit, or I would study for them, but then I'd get to the test and it would be all multiple choice, and then I'd read all the answers and be like, yeah, all these seem fine.
That happened to me in high school history too, actually.
Yeah, I just didn't... I enjoyed and I continue to enjoy, like, engaging in, like, verbal discussions and or, like, I would go to history talk.
Yeah.
And I would listen, but I cannot commit the series of events to memory.
I can't imagine that I would be a history major if I had to memorize a few things. Now, obviously, like, a lot of things have been repeated to me, right? So many times they become natural. And, you know, major theories and stuff I've had to memorize a bit, but there's a misconception that history majors just memorize dates and facts.
Well, I'm not saying that you do.
Which I don't think I do, and I think if I did, I don't think I'd like the major.
Did I suggest that?
No, I really believe in, like, making history accessible to everyone and making it a thing that is attuned to present concerns and can be liberatory. And I want people to know that, like, history isn't what it used to be in, like, the 1800s. Like, history is cool. It's where the cool kids go to think about topics through the past.
Do you feel like you have, like, a large platform that you're speaking to right now? You're like, I want people to know.
Well, you know, Alex, if you ever, like, had the chance to go to college again, right? You know, I think you'd be a great history major. You know,
I did dabble in the history department one time.
You took T.C. Jackson, right?
No. I did an independent study in Armenian cultural history with Rachel Washington.
That's right. That's how you did that.
It was History 291, independent study. Mm-hmm. I remember the name of it. But I really just, like, hated all the history parts. Rachel would give me these readings, and I don't even think they were, in a way, historical as much as, like, cultural studies. And a little bit of legal studies that I, like, pursuit of my own. Maybe some history. I learned specific history of, like, the nation building of the Turkish nation. But all in all, I think I did a history class as far away from history as possible.
It's valid. I mean, history is all interpretation, right? And so as long as you're interpreting things that happened in the past, you're doing history. It's not just memorizing facts or things, right?
Oh, yeah, I just feel like I took the history, like, not that I took it for Rachel Goshgarian in any way, doctor.
I wouldn't blame you.
But I'm saying...
She's a lovely professor and lovely person.
She is the only person on this campus whom I could have, I think, effectively done the research I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it happened to have been done through the historical lens because she is a historian.
Yeah.
But that's not where... I didn't want to end up in history, but she was the research person whom made this accessible to me.
So you were more interested in, like, maybe present concerns? Is that what I'm hearing?
I'll tell you my research topic. It was on cultural heritage objects in modern Eastern Turkey. So primarily churches, homes, other cultural centers.
Yeah.
And their deliberate destruction in the Armenian genocide, as well as contemporary destruction as a result of, like, neglect and or violence towards them.
Mm-hmm.
And so my project was on looking at one specific, I ended up doing a church, one specific church in eastern Turkey, and seeing what preservation efforts have been taken on it, if any, what destruction has occurred on it, and what could be done to restore this church. And concurrently, what, like, legal ramifications, what is the legal backing behind the destruction, the preservation? And yeah.
So you were more interested in, like, the law?
Kind of. It was both, like, the history of it and, like, how it got us to where we are now. But, yes, mostly it was, like, an argumented paper about, like, why this should be considered more strongly as, like, by the UN, as a, I don't remember the terms now, like, a site of cultural heritage destruction, like a threatened site.
Yeah.
Why the UN should pay attention to this. Does it qualify? Does the Turkish government include this in any of their, like, legal code? I don't have the terms anymore. It's been, like, a year.
I definitely see where that is, and I see the kind of frustration with history, right? Because in history, too, sometimes, like, we're so part of political discussions about, like, you know, is this cultural heritage? Is this cultural heritage destruction? But you also have to be careful, right, when you're putting those terms on the past. And that's not to excuse people in the past, but that's to say, like, they were using different frameworks to understand it for better and often for worse.
Oh, this is true. I mean, I don't think they considered... I don't think that those committing, the Young Turks committing the Armenian genocide, loved as destruction, but rather as, like, they were, you know, saving.
Yeah.
Saving the people of Turkey and the world from the horrible Armenians. And yet the Armenian people were like, well, obviously you're destroying our property.
Yeah.
So I guess it depends on who you're listening to.
It's amazing, you know, how people can do such horrible things, right? I mean, and we want to make sure when we do history that we're not excusing them, because we can't let bad things happen.
Yeah. Did you watch Russian Doll?
I don't really watch TV.
No, it's on Netflix. Starring Natasha Lyonne. It's an excellent, excellent TV show.
Oh.
It's trippy and, like, mind-bending. I don't want to say sci-fi exactly, but, like, it involves, like, time travel and kind of like the Groundhog's Day, like, waking up over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And in the most recent second season of it, the main character enters a time loop. She's Jewish, and I apologize for the fire truck noises. She enters a time loop where she's brought back into, like, the 1940s.
Oh.
And, well, it goes back to the 80s and then ultimately the 40s, but she, can I tell you what happens?
Sure.
You might watch it, but...
Yeah.
She ends up, going back... She ends up in the 1940s in Vienna, where her family is from.
Oh, no.
And is... No, she is, like, tasked. She figures out that it's, her, like, her destiny to do this. Is to, like, save her family's belongings from the Nazis. The Nazis, like, took... I don't know what the historical accuracy of this is, but this is the show's portrayal of what happened, is that the Nazis came in... and said, we're taking your belongings, but you'll get them back. Here's a piece of paper, which you will use later to get your things.
Mm-hmm.
None of the things were intended to be handed back. But she, like, finds a piece of paper, and it says, like, the location of where the Nazis left it. So she uses it to, like, track down her family's belongings, and she takes them and, like, saves, I don't know, her family's precious belongings from Nazis. So it wasn't like she was tasked with... That's the question of, you know, do you kill baby Hitler? But it was like, this is happening, and how do you protect your family? This is a really loud location.
It is. I didn't expect it. I thought, you know, we're all secluded on the hill. Like, but you can never be secluded from the places around you. We're all interconnected, so.
You can never escape industrialized society.
No.
I mean, look at us. We tried to find solace in nature, but with what? Our technical equipment.
Yeah.
That we're using for this podcast.
I hope everyone listening at home is thankful for the advancements of technology. I mean, these conversations would be lost without this technology. So I'm glad we have the opportunity to record it.
Right.
I'm glad you have the opportunity to listen. Right. I mean, this is a record of what people were talking about in 2022. This is a record of the dynamics people talked with.
Right. I think I was intending not to say this in the beginning. This is, I think, my fifth episode. So I've been, over the course of doing them, I've developed this perspective on these podcasts. I think it's more than, because I don't have a topic,
mm-hmm.
it's just becoming kind of a time capsule.
Yeah.
Of my relationships with others and just letting conversations go wherever they go. That's why it's called Lost in IKEA.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we successfully went through a variety of topics.
Mm-hmm. Who's been your favorite podcast guest so far?
I needed to answer that question, Stefano. That is not for me to say, but perhaps the listeners to think about.
It sounds like you have one, though.
No, I don't.
Yeah, okay.
I don't. I would need to... No, I couldn't begin. That would be a question suggestive to who's my favorite friend.
No, it's who did you have the best conversation with?
Mm-hmm. I don't know. There would have to be metrics involved.
You'd want to do it fairly.
I'm not a I'm quite indecisive. I'm not good at making subjective decisions. Mm-hmm. I'm very logical, and therefore I could not come up with an answer on the spot that would be well grounded.
That is fair. I appreciate your time, care, and attention into doing it right.
Right. I won't do it at all. Mm. I'm just saying those are the steps that I would take.
I think I will listen and decide.
Oh,
myself.
You will decide. I think that you're a highly biased candidate for that role.
I won't listen to mine because I know this is the best one anyway.
Okay. I will allow that sentence to pass in time, such that I don't respond to it.
Mm. You know, I'm really glad we have this podcast because, I mean, I love talking to you, Alex. But to be honest, like this amount of time to be talking with you, when else would we get it? Would we plan this ourselves?
An hour-long discussion. Well, you were saying you're glad that this conversation was recorded, and I frankly don't think this conversation would have happened.
Yeah, I mean, that's
the
thing.
Recording.
And I think the recording might change how we talk. I mean, it's definitely changing our volumes, our pace, right? And perhaps it's changing the content. But on the other hand, this is a really valuable record because we would not have gotten it otherwise.
I will say, you are the only person so far, I think, who I've not had difficulty overlapping with. I think you're a good, I don't know if it's in virtue of being like a conversationalist or the fact that you just like to speak succinct, maybe not succinct, but you like to speak with purpose.
Yeah.
And thought. So I think that you are one of the few people who I've not had to say like, hey, let's not overlap or all that jazz. So kudos to you, I guess.
You know, they always say, right, to listen before you speak. And I really try to take that to heart. Anything that you say, I think it's really important for me to process, for me to engage with, right? And I believe that if this is a conversation, I need to be listening to you, you need to be listening to me, you need to be in community.
That's so profound. Do you believe that is actually how you carry yourself, or are you just doing this for the sake of this podcast?
Well, you know me outside of this.
I do. You're much more, I don't want to say that you're faking it, but you're really holding yourself more tightly wound, I think, than you are when you're not being recorded.
Well, I didn't want to swear on the radio.
That's
in case
fair.
in case anyone's listening. You know,
I appreciate that.
The world is my audience, and the world includes my mom, so we're not going
to
sweat.
Right, you're more than welcome to share this with your mom.
I wonder what she would think.
Or anybody. I hope that I didn't say anything crude.
You swore once, it's okay.
Right. No, not swearing. I've talked about some pretty... In the same way, before we were discussing this, before we start recording, you and I were talking about inappropriate content versus, like, profane content.
Mm.
And I've shared some inappropriate content on other episodes.
Really?
Not profane.
Wow, I can't wait to listen.
Things that I know some people might take objection to.
Wow. I thought this was family friendly. I'm going to swear all about.
I guess it depends on your definition of that.
Mm.
There's no rating. There's no official rating. To the content of this.
NC-17.
Wouldn't it be funny if you just made, like, an NC-17 movie that was just PG? Like, it fit the guidelines of being PG, but you just decided to call it NC-17 for, like, as a test.
I thought the Motion Picture Association of America or whatever got to choose the rating. Because if everyone chose the rating, then, you know, anything R-rated would just be PG-13.
But also, it's important to consider the history. Because PG-13 movies in the 1980s are certainly more vulgar than PG-13 movies now.
Really?
I mean, PG movies in the 1980s are more vulgar than PG movies now.
Really? I feel like PG movies can get a little vulgar. I think you're allowed a little bit.
A little bit, but there's certainly, like, profanity in PG movies in the 80s. Some nudity. Or just, like, I think discussion... I think that they thought that PG was, like, no sex, no obscene cursing. Whereas it's really more about, like, intensity, I guess.
Hmm.
I don't know. Like, some PG movies in the 80s, I can't remember what. But one of them was just, like, I remember watching it, and it was super violent and scary. But it didn't have, like, any bad curse words or, like, sex scenes in it. So they were like, yeah, kids can watch this.
Huh.
I guess we'll have to bring in a FAMS major to really flesh out. Is there anybody that's FAMS and history?
Excellent question. Not this year, I don't think.
Okay, because that would be, I guess, my perfect guest.
Mm.
Not that I'm really planning on delving more into history with others. Perhaps you're my only historical, as some might say, historical guest.
Ah. You know, I'd like to see this as an opportunity for education. I think this is an opportunity for a listener to listen and gain some new perspective about the world. And the world isn't just what's going on today. It's the world it's been here for a long time.
So true. There is no planet B.
It's no planet B.
I'll just throw in a random climate change saying, and I'm not going to address climate change now because I'm hungry.
Hmm.
I think we should wrap up. Do you have any closing remarks? Any closing questions? Anything you would like to say to me, to the listeners, before we tie this up?
Wow, that's really putting me on the spot. I'm really thankful for the weather, for cooperating. If we had to do this inside, it just wouldn't be the same. But I'm also thankful for all of the little moments of fortune that brought me to this moment. And I always think of the ways that our relationship has evolved over the last few years. And also, like, our personal growth. And I think that's part of what college is supposed to be. So thank you for being part of my journey. And listener, like, I hope this is part of your journey. I hope you learned something. I hope you took something new.
That was very well and genuinely put. Thank you, Stefano.
Thank you, Alex.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. This has been another episode of Lost in IKEA with Alex Kasparian. Today, my guest, if you're just tuning in for whatever reason, you skipped to the end of the episode. My guest today was Stefano Mancini. Please say your name for the record.
Stefano Mancini.
Great, I said it right. just wanted to clarify that at the end right there. No. Thank you for listening, and I hope you check out the next episode whenever that is, because I'm not going on any schedule anymore.
Ah.
Yep. Goodbye.
Goodbye.